When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This week, we're covering Season 1, Episode 3, titled The Mathematician's Ghost. Respect and enjoy the podcast. All right, Aaron. What'd you think of The Mathematician's Ghost?
I really like this episode. I'm still kind of like keeping my guard up. Because, you know, this show did receive some mixed reviews from the critic.
But I'm starting to think that, like, Steppenwolf is still haunting you.
Yeah, the television critic's ghost is looming large over these proceedings. And but I'm starting to feel a lot more confident that, like, I'm just a lot more receptive to this type of storytelling. Like, this kind of episode where it just spends a lot of time dealing with, like, the implications of a certain type of governance and, like, the how the art and the ritual and all that stuff kind of reinforces, like, this peaceful transfer of power. What is the experience of, like, living this life that's a singular life, but it's also the same life as 11 people lived before you, and that you're about to, like, accept your death, and how this was, like, stuff that, like, the first Klingon obsessed about. I thought that stuff was really, really fascinating and interesting, and I'm so glad, and it's such a great way to tell the story of, like, an empire's decline too. Mm-hmm. That, like, you know, the old man finally figured out something profound to say in his last hours of his life, and then his teenage punk descendant wipes it away because he thinks it's baby stuff. Like, I just thought that shit was great, and I just thought it was so fascinating. The lore and the world building of the empire was great. And determinist stuff, I felt like, in comparison, kind of suffered because it wasn't as colorful and interesting and, you know, kind of thought provoking, but it had to do a lot of heavy lifting as far as plots. And I thought that I kind of thought that the ghosts and the house kind of metaphor, I wasn't sure about that. But by the end of the episode, I thought it was a pretty elegant way to, you know, talk about this thing in metaphor, but then also to bring it around to the reality that, like, kind of the chickens are home to roost and kind of an interesting way.
And so connect the two halves of the show. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I was kind of shocked that we didn't get any more developments about, like, Gale and the manner of Harry's death, what that meant, you know, and that, like, I imagine we will get answers, but the show is not interested in them right now, which I think could be frustrating, but I was so fascinated by the other stuff, I didn't really mind it. How did you find this episode?
I feel like a TV watcher, the way that I think Brother Dusk feels about the world and life. Like, it's only at the very tail end of his life that he's sort of opening his mind to bigger questions, right? He's pondering, like, there's a theme of, like, building versus stagnation or even destruction in this episode. And I think he's just now grappling with those issues at the very tail end of his life, which I feel like I have seen so many television shows at this point that have kind of stagnated into this very small storytelling, this intimate storytelling. And that's fine. I love those shows. But this is kind of kicking open new doors, new ways of telling stories. And now I really understand kind of why people say, is this thing even filmable? Because this show is not going to hold your hand too much, right? It'll give you 400 years earlier, 400 years later, 35 years, 17. It'll tell you those, but it is not going to really hold your hand through what is a fairly rough transition of Brother Darkness or the old Brother Dusk aging out of the Brother Dusk role and the new clone not being born yet, right? There's mm-hmm. a Lee Pace in this episode that is not the same Lee Pace that we saw last episode, and they don't tell you that until, like, 40 mm-hmm. minutes into this episode or whatever. So
yeah,
but I found that fascinating, right? And I found like very much the same thing you were talking about with the thematic connections between the two sections of this episode, the two halves. I've seen episodes do things like that before, but the kind of scale they're doing it on here is something I don't think I have ever seen. And I'm really enjoying it for what it is.
Yeah, there's something on the official podcast that I enjoyed today. I was listening to the showrunner Goyer saying that one thing they wanted to get right in front. There's like two non-human characters in this show. One of them is the Vault, which is still very mysterious. And the other one is time itself. And that you have to feel like time is something that affects things and it controls the pacing of things. And they wanted the audience, like, it's like a hard check that, like, you have to be cool with this character, like, having it say and making big changes, you know, just in a way that like a villain or a hero would, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought this episode kind of typified that, like, yeah, if you're not into like, oh, 400 years, 400. 19 years after the start, if you're not like willing to put forth the effort to do a little bit of math and kind of like go with that flow, it's probably because you're going to be like, what the fuck is any of this stuff?
Yeah. They're using it so well to tell the story of a stagnated empire. I really appreciated what they were doing this episode. On so many levels too.
Like, it's not just a, like, this is just a surface level. Like, they constantly reinforce and interweave other things in this episode to help you appreciate that as well.
That narration that we get from Salvor, I think, or is it Gail?
I still think this is Gail. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That narration is like connecting both of those halves. It's sort of bridging the gap between the old and the new, and you know, like going forward into the future while also not forgetting the lessons of the past, which I think everybody can identify with, right? Unless, I don't know, you're 15, then you don't have any lessons of the past.
Sure. But, then you reach it like this so you can kind of like get a leg up on things.
Yeah, for sure. So that's what I thought. I thought it was great. Probably better, actually, than the first two episodes. I
kind of agree too. Taking a step back, and like, I felt like also the show just was felt very confident and unhurried. Like, you know, if you were curious about how this genetic dynasty ruled, then you're going to get a lot of cool, satisfying answers. And it's going to have a lot of like, you know, Android ennui mixed into it. And if this is the type of show you're in for, then this is a preview. If not, you know, exits are to the left. It is wild that like, this is, kind of like a David Simon show in that it doesn't really care to hold your hand and introduce you to concepts. Like, it expects you to at least give it four or five episodes to click before, you know, it's not as interested in, you know, entertaining you as it is in getting you to think about different ideas. And I know it sounds kind of like, I don't know, like artsy fartsy or elitist, but it's, I don't think it is. I think it's just like, there's, you know, if you try to be a show for everybody, then you're going to come across as generic and an afterthought. But if you can try to be a show for a particular type of person, then you might be able to like really move the ball forward in terms of like what you're trying to say, you know, because you'll get a person that's willing to meet you halfway, which means you don't have to do twice the work to express your ideas. I think there's time and place for all that stuff. Like, you know, I love my MCU. And my John Wick and that shit, but like this is like very espresso and or like a really hoppy beer. You gotta kind of acquire a taste for it. And I've been a fucking giant nerd all my life, and it's paid off now in 2021.
And you can still like The Mandalorian and this show. You know you're allowed to. So let's not get all snobby like about Grogu. It, but also let's appreciate the things that it's doing that are unique and original.
Yeah, I just like that there is this lane that is now being occupied by not just one, but several vehicles. Like, it's like, this is such a huge improvement from the most of my, you know, child and adult life that like, at best, you'd get a science fiction wave. It's like pop culture sci-fi. But like this kind of stuff, this weird shit, like Dune and thing, I'm really excited.
Right. Dune's coming up pretty soon. We talk about The Expanse a lot, that being a great show, but even that isn't doing the same type of thing that this is doing. You know, it's servicing more realistical, like socio-political type of thing, but
Yeah.
This is kind of taking it and just blowing the scale up. Sure. And I'm really digging it so far.
Yeah. Like, yeah, Expanse is still a commentary on like early 21st century political climate, environmental climate, stuff like that. Whereas mm-hmm. this is like thousands of years of human history taking a step back and looking at how, like, in a broad scheme, like civilizations rise and fall. So it's great. It's great. And I'm loving it so far.
Yeah. Well, how about we get into the recap?
Let's do it.
All right. First, let's take a break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right, we start off. I don't know how you can start off an episode earlier, but this starts off 400 years earlier. We've got the original emperor, Cleon the First. He's dying. He's talking with Demerzel about the future of his empire and his legacy. And she tells him that his continuity is assured. He's having a bit of a pre-death crisis here.
I mean, this strikes at something we've talked a lot about in terms of cloning. Like, you know, continuity of consciousness, man. You can have a clone, even if it has 100% intact your memories and your thoughts and feelings, which as far as I can tell, these clones do not. You know, it's a big ask to tell the person that's going to be disintegrated that, oh yeah, you're going to live on in this other thing. It's going to be just like, you know, and I think you see a lot of that kind of like frustration. Like, this is my brainchild and I should be able to see it, not me in like the second sense, but my eyes and my mind, my comprehension should be able to see it. And the frustration that you can't, even though you're going to live forever, you're not going to live forever, old man.
Yeah.
I thought that's great.
I also, when he's standing here talking to Demerzel, he's looking out the window, looking at the Star Bridge that is yet to be fully constructed. It's in the process. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about, you know, things that can be sort of interchangeably used to describe his Star Bridge or himself as a clone emperor. And I think it's interesting because that, I think, is in a nutshell the entire first half of this episode, let's say, because what he's doing there is he's talking about wishing that he could see his legacy fulfilled in the form of this Star Bridge, which to me represents growth or building something, creation. And then he's also fretting about this clone thing, which to me represents stagnation. And I think the episode and the show so far has told us that it's basically stagnated. And in some ways, destruction, right? You see what happens later on with the Star Bridge, and his legacy is destroyed at the hands of his legacy, which it's right. It's crazy what they're doing here. But I really started to appreciate in this very first scene, the kind of thematic stuff that they're going for.
The other thing I want to talk about is there's a lot of talk also with Demerzel, and they mention, you know, that he's talking about like, he sees her as a vital piece of the continuity, and they're definitely, I mean, they haven't explicitly said that, but like almost all the emperors agree that they greatly value her advice and her opinion. Like, she's kind of the yardstick they measure themselves, because she's the only one that's known all of them, but she's also in a precarious position because for some, you know, reason, there is a robot rebellion, there's a robot war, her kind were kind of eradicated, as far as we know. So she's kind of like a singular person as well. And I couldn't help but note there might be some double talk in the beginning of this where they're talking about, you spent more time with the systems programmers than me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, are we talking about her programming? Are we talking about the spaceport's programming? What, like, there's an ambiguity in there, just like there has been in her role the whole time.
Yeah,
you know, like the fact that this guy and his personage is called Empire, but also it's the entire system. When she says it's always on her mind, is she talking about the person, or is she talking about there's mm-hmm. I think there is some room that they're suggesting some kind of duplicitous, that she is loyal to something, but it's not necessarily this dynasty of men. Do you feel like any of that?
I do. And I think that would lean nicely into the thematic stuff I was talking about with creation, stagnation, and destruction, because you could have all three in this scene if she is sort of the downfall of the Empire, or at least the Empire as we know it, with these clone Cleons, clone nons.
Yeah.
I don't know how to portmanteau that. But yeah, I get the feeling, like, when she's saying my mind is, you know, the Empire is always on my mind, for good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very non-specific, like you said, double talk sort of thing that you could say. So
something a stalker could say, and it's menacing.
Sure.
<you know? laughs>
I don't know if I'm reading too much into this or looking for something that's not there, but.
And I always just keep coming back to that scene where she's explaining that, you know, my kind didn't die out. They were exterminated by your kind. Mm. And the actress, who has a very controlled and precise performance, definitely put some heat and spin on that delivery. And I, you know, as will be explored throughout this episode, it's like, what does it even mean for a robot like this to have feelings for people, for institutions, for things, ambitions? Like, it might not. You know, me saying that she's angry about something might be something that she's just like aping, or a piece of programming she's following. I thought that was interesting too. Like, these, when this robot's talking about missing people and longing for things, what does that actually mean? Because it probably doesn't mean the same thing it means to myself as a human.
Yeah. Let me play robot's advocate for a second and talk about how devastating, after this scene, how devastating the destruction of the Star Bridge must be for Demerzel. If you look at this episode, she's seeing the creation of it and how much it means to Cleon the First, right? And I get the sense through this episode that there is very much a deep connection between specifically her and Cleon the First, maybe slightly more so than the rest of the clones. And so when I look at these scenes and I watch Cleon's ancestors, if that's even the right term for clone ancestors, going up into orbit and destroying the platform at the end of this episode. You can look on Dimrizel's face and see that that is really affecting to her. Is that affecting only because it is Cleon the First's legacy that they're destroying, or because it's Cleon the First's ancestors destroying his legacy? You know, there's so much tied up, so many layers to this onion when it comes to the Emperor and Dimrizel.
Yeah, and to play robot's advocate, and to bolster that point, like, I think that there might be something special about the first one, because like there's this word, and I've used it a bunch on the podcast too, because it's been on my mind. Singular is used, I think, two or three times in regard as to something about the Empire in the first half of this episode. And, you know, thanks for helping me feel, you know, unique as I'm shuffling off into the obscurity or whatever. Klingon the First was, like all the others, for better or worse, she raised from a clone. They had the exact same trajectory. 30 years later, she decanted another one. 30 years later, she decanted another one. She said goodbye. They are like the same thing that just keeps repeating. But that first time has to be special, right? Mm-hmm. The time where they were figuring everything out, where everything was uncertain, whether there wasn't. Like, I actually do think that in her mind, that the first one is the greatest and the one that she felt maybe most, indebted to or on the level of, and the others else are just like, you know, they're children, you know, and they always will be to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be something. I think there's a lot to that.
All right. Then we jump 400 years into the future. From where we were in the past, Brother Dust is looking out at the falling Starbridge platform and pondering his own death. This is kind of exactly a mirror, just 400 years in the future of the shot before. Mm-hmm. Dimrizel tells him about how hard it was for Cleon the First in his final days, and then sends him to see the tailor. And this is a scene where you're talking about, you know, the uniqueness, right? And how she's trying to assure you every one of you is different. He's very much not buying that. Thank you for, you know, trying to make me feel unique as I shuffle off this stage. And all of this idea of uniqueness ties in with the second half of this episode with Salvor, right? Who is also unique and is trying to make sure that people know that that doesn't necessarily mean you're special. It just means you're different.
And here's where the concept of the time as a character you have to pay attention to, because when it said 400 years earlier, I think a lot of people would assume when it says 400 years sooner that it's going to essentially mean where we left off in the last episode, but it's not. It's actually 19 years past the spaceport bombing, which they helpfully add with a little caption. But if you're not paying attention to that stuff, then you might, you know, have gotten confused about like who is, you know, Lee Pace, where did the kid go? Like, and then when it says then the show later says now. Which is a completely fucking relative concept. Like, is so, but it might be like the first frame of reference we started the show with, you know, Salver with the kids by the Null Field. So, but it, yeah, you really have to stay on your toes for sure.
Does that imply that whatever is happening now, it's because Gale is the narrator, that would also be in the now?
I don't know, because Gale makes references to things that are happening quite a bit further in the future in the first episode, which she lists off.
But that whole episode
names.
Takes
all...
place almost 35 years in the past, right?
You're right. So yeah. So what kind of omniscient is she, like speaking from within psychohistory? Like she is looking forward
that
and backwards? Because I don't think she has some. I could be wrong, but I don't think there's like some God Emperor turn where someone other than like this clone thing, like I don't think they literally have like humans that live for thousands of years in this saga. I don't think they go to Dune Trend, but like, yeah, I assume the only frame of reference she could possibly take is as a, you know, in-depth psychohistorian.
Yeah.
Cause she does have like an out of time on almost omniscient narration style.
Yeah. And it could be she's, it doesn't really sound like she's reading from the Encyclopedia Galactica, which is, you know, the framing of at least that first book. So I don't know what they're doing, but I'm wondering if she's not in the 35 years later section of the first two episodes or the now section of this episode. We'll see. Because you're right.
Did I mention last episode the idea that like Gale might be the vault?
Can't remember.
Did I mention that last episode? Because like it would make sense that like maybe she was sent like. Well, maybe we'll talk about that in the foundation or the terminus half of the episode.
Yeah, I think we did talk about.
I think I just laid it out there as a pot, like a Gonzo possibility, but like some stuff that happened in the second half of this episode kind of like reawakened that in that idea.
Gotcha. So the tailor fits Brother Dusk for what we find out are his funeral garments later. The tailor thinks he screwed it up with his shaky hands, but Brother Dusk thinks it's perfect. He does, however, request that the tailor's young assistant put the final touches on it, which I think is less about it being perfect because of shaky hands and more about this generational passing of knowledge, right?
Yeah, like Brother Dusk's like seems like one of his chief roles is to smooth the transition, you know, and to encourage the older things to yield to the younger things. And mm-hmm. I thought it's cool that he's doing that even in matters as small as the fitting.
Yeah.
And here too, like when he said it's a singular garment, what the hell does that mean? There's been 12 exact. I mean, they're not exact; they're different. But like these funerary robes, it's silly to say something like that. And I think that's part of the tragedy of Brother Dusk is like as in his twilight, he realizes the absurdity.
Yeah,
you know, like at the end of this long, beautiful day, like all these things about uniqueness and oh, I'm the painter and I'm this. It's like it's all just bullshit and what mm-hmm. and meaningless.
I couldn't help but think what a shame it is this tailor who is going to all this trouble to get the perfect outfit and create this beautiful garment only to have it disintegrated. It must be what it's like to be a chef, right? You make this beautiful plate of food and then you have some cretin come in and just devour it.
It's just the experience, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I also, did you notice, because I watched this episode, I think, three times or like carefully twice than I had on the background as doing my notes. But like I was moved to check to see what the belly button situation was, because they later established that the umbilical cord enters into the back of the clone somewhere. And I was gratified to know it wasn't a great job. But when the Emperor climbs up on his little dais, the mirror catches him a couple times just right to see his belly. And they've sure enough silly puttied his belly button hole. it's
why?
Not perfect. It's not because you wouldn't. That's a fact. If the belly button's an umbilical scar, man. If you didn't have an umbilical cord, you presumably
wouldn't the body just be naturally set up to use that as the port? Like
that's the thing. I don't know why you would move it. I don't know why you'd move it to the back. That's the thing. I don't know. And like also, I was looking for like a back button. You know, and I didn't see any. It's hard because his whole back was a constellation of like liver spots. It's like a spilt coin, purse of coins.
Jesus.
To use the Aussies poetic language later on. But yeah, no, you're trying to you at least silly puttied the belly button. I appreciate that. Good job.
Whether it makes sense or not, at least they've abided by their continuity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you notice something else that technically was weird with this episode? And I don't know if this is my TV and my audio settings or what, but this was very noisy audio, extremely noisy. And you could tell that there were some times when the voice was dubbed over and it sounded total like you could tell they were in a recording booth versus the stuff that was recorded probably on set.
I did not notice that. I did not. And I have a fan running in the room where I was watching this and taking notes. So maybe I didn't notice the background. It's not a pristine audio environment, but I didn't. That's interesting.
Okay. I didn't know. Maybe people can write in and let me know if that's my TV, because I will change the settings. If not, the show is a little bit dodgy with its audio occasionally.
Hmm.
So then Brother Dusk is questioning everything, including the future of the Outer Reach and Harry Seldon's words. And they're standing kind of in front of this globe thing right now, or not even a globe. It's like a picture of, I guess it's like a depiction of the Outer Reach. It must be.
Yeah. The barbarian kingdoms.
Yeah. These planets that they were shooting at the end of last episode.
Yeah.
The other brothers assure him, no, the Empire's strong. Don't worry about anything. Dusk wants to save Klee on the first dream by trying to like push the Starbridge platform back up into space or something. Doesn't come down on their heads. And Brother Day tells him to forget the legacy of Klee on the first because, or to forget the Starbridge because we are the legacy of Klee on the first, the dream of Klee on the first. And this is the first time that you see Lee Pace and what we would conventionally think of as Brother Dusk in the same room with the Brother Dusk that is getting very old and about to die.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point they're still named Brother Dawn and Brother Day. Mm-hmm. It's just that
yep.
Lee Pace is Brother Dawn. Now
yeah.
he's aged, you know, 30 years. I did some
it
math.
It seems like they're exactly 30 years
yes.
apart.
Yeah. Yeah. I did some math and it was 400 plus 17 that we get later on with the young
right.
version of,
yeah.
Or I guess the older version of Dawn, but not quite Lee Pace Dawn.
So this was the 11-year-old we saw, you know, bemoaning the choices they're having to make in the first one.
Right.
Lee Pace
yeah. we knew before has aged into what we view as Brother Dusk.
Yeah.
And you got Brother yeah. Darkness here, who isn't quite Brother Darkness yet, I think.
He will be tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucking cool. I liked all the ceremonial stuff too. I also love the synchronized gestures. Which is kind of, you know, like every once in a while I'll see my son like roll his eyes in exactly the same way I roll my eye. And I like there's got to be something genetic to that. It's probably also it's probably learned too.
Sure.
But like they both make the same kind of like, you know, the dismissive gesture with their chin. And they do this throughout the episode. I just like it. I like that continuity. And it doesn't even seem practiced. It's just. Yeah, they're feeling the exact same way and reacting the exact same way to it. And it's just subtle shit like that that I think this show does really well with this stuff.
Yeah. It really struck me in this episode, the contrast between the longevity and power of the Emperor versus the understanding that the Emperor has of the world. He seems very dismissive of everything that is outside of his interest, I guess. Mm-hmm. And his interest is very small. His interest is isolated to whatever he's feeling that day or the details on some gift from some, you know, outer reach planet. He's missing all of the bigger picture things, which is what Brother Dusk is just now starting to open up to, right? And you get this sense of like, boy, the Empire is so vast and the Emperor is so powerful, and yet there's this short-sightedness to it all. It's remarkable, the contrast there.
Oh, yeah. And they do a lot of that with Terminus kind of flourishing in the trade and outer, like as the Empire recedes, it gives, you know, it's almost better to have like no Imperial control than it is to have like careless or disinterested Imperial control, because that can like put a wet blanket over everything. Whereas if they just completely pull out, you could have like, you know,
yeah,
it's better. Hey, it's better for the backwaters to free trade amongst themselves than it is to like trade through the central empire and get all, you know, it's just kind of like, the empire is no longer efficient for those same reasons. We talked about that last week that like, he talks about how you have to pay attention and everything's about the details.
Yeah.
Yet the emperor in the same notion is scoffing at like, oh, these primitive backwaters, we can give them 12 hours of our attention and they're going to think it's going to, you know, it'll be the most important 12 hours in their lives. But like, it's just like the ultimate echo chamber, you mm-hmm. know, like he's been in it for 400 fucking years of the empire catering to his tastes and his thoughts and his prejudices. And look where it's gotten. Whereas before, you know, a new guy could come along and at least have a fresh perspective. You're trying very hard to eliminate that.
Yeah. And I the contrast that I love so much is the longevity of the Emperor as a being or an entity, right? But also the short-sightedness of that entity. And then this individual in this copy of Klee-on that's mind is opening up, mm-hmm. having sort of the expansive vision beyond that, only at the very end, right? It's like this perpetual cycle of like birth of thought and death of thought in like the same day, it seems, right? Like yep. It can never make any progress because the moment that awakens, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild.
And the tragedy seems like all the emperors kind of arrive at these conclusions right as they're about to ascend.
Right.
You know, Rai's like, you know what? We've got this whole it gets zapped.
Yeah. And that got me thinking about Demerzel's role in this whole thing. Is she there to simply serve the whims of the emperor, or is she there to be sort of a generational mind for the empire? Because as much as, you know, you would impart your wisdom, if your wisdom is flawed because of being myopic or whatever over however many generations the emperor has been doing this, 15, 14, something like that.
I think this is the 14th, this nucleon. Yeah.
Yeah. Is she there to kind of keep everything moving in a direction?
And what's her agenda? Because she could absolutely shape the shit out of these kids.
Sure.
You know, like whatever Cleon the First was, like maybe what they are now is what she's molded them to be carefully over 400 years.
I wonder if that was part of Cleon's. There's a very specific structure to this cloning operation, right? We mentioned how every 30 years another clone is made, and they are, you know, there's this continual wave of Cleons both rising and falling.
Except for the first one that apparently got to 90 before the baby was ready to cook. So
yeah. Yeah, and only had the baby and Demerzel when he shuffled off. It makes me wonder if that was sort of a safeguard against any possible tampering by Demerzel, right? Because you do have a sort of institutional understanding and knowledge in the Cleons, in the wave form of the Cleons, right?
This is right, because you like the if you start, you know, brainwashing Brother Dawn, presumably Brother Dusk and Day will be like, the fuck is going on here?
Right.
But you did have that first clone that you know she was able to do, and there was no guarding over it whatsoever.
And I think it necessarily stagnates the Cleons. They aren't able to very well adapt, I would think, over the years.
100%. Like all the wisdom that was imparted by their predecessor is secondhand. And you said, like, imagine like what kind of butterfly flap you could just change, like some small part of that wave that's going to magnify and further generations. Maybe you wanted to destabilize and stagnate the empire because you wanted to bring it down because you're fucking pissed that they wiped out your kind.
Right.
I don't know.
Could be.
It could be something that's happening. Again, it's not me. I've read the books, but like I said, there were no robots in the books I read. So
yeah,
this is just me riffing with what I'm seeing here.
For sure. All right. We move on to Brother Dusk walking I don't know if there's an official name for this room, but it's a hall with all the Emperor's likenesses in it. And they all kind of have labels. The dreamer, the scholar, the alchemist, and the painter, which is the current Brother Dusk. Demerzel comes in and fetches Brother Dusk so that the brothers can give him his last gift.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. They're trying to tell the story of the decline. You got the dreamer and the scholar and the alchemist and the architect and all this, and then you got the painter, which if we recall, all of the brothers paint all the time. Like that's their hobby is to paint that. Like they talked about like this successive generations add and keeps evolving. So the fact that he's the emperor known for indulging in the imperial hobby the most. I just thought that they don't ever say explicitly that is, but he kind of like can tell that he feels inferior. In fact, He reveals in the scene that he feels self-conscious because he never could look as imperial as the first emperor. He never could master that. Like, oh yeah, look at that. Look at that bastard up there. That's a guy you want to clone forever. Not me. I can't be that guy. I thought it's interesting how, you know, kind of pathetic it all was.
And then there's a gift of a meal, which is not the full gift. The real gift is a flight up to the Starbridge platform where they both destroy it and promise to build a greater legacy in the future.
So I kept on thinking the scale of the technology we talked about and the power of the Empire that we've already seen. They can harness a black hole to travel through space instantaneously. They can fucking turn an entire surface of a world to glass if they want to. They could do all these things. They're so powerful. when you see an abandoned space station that was the centerpiece of their legacy just floating around 19 years and scientists like, oh, gee, it might crash any moment now. That implies a failure of will more than like power and wealth, right? Like imagine like, yeah. So we just got done with the 20th anniversary of 9/11 here in America. Imagine if like 20 years after the two holes of the Twin Towers were still smoking craters, because in 20 years, no political regime could get the capital and the political will together to do anything, to approve a plan. Maybe it's not popular, but just fucking do something, build something there. Imagine 100 years goes by and they're just fucking smoking craters still like that. That says something about like it's with all the power and money that you have available. You can't get that fucking thing done. You can't bring together. It implies something about the rot that is. And then, you know, like I said, we're not that far gone. We can still do things in this country. Mm-hmm. But this is what the Empire's doing.
They can pick an afternoon, drive up there and blow it up. Right. They could have solved this problem. You're right. All along. They had it within their power.
Yes. Yeah. And they just chose not to. And in fact, I think the old man realizes he's being had. I think Brother Darkness here realizes when they blow it up that like, oh, you're not going to build something greater. This is just to make me feel better on my last day. And you guys are going to go back to whatever version of bread and circuses you're indulging in right now.
And it's that very
population.
Like, it's that myopic view again, right? Like this is a slap in the face to Brother Dusk, who has just awakened to the fact that this was Cleon the First's legacy, right? And what does it mean? And he created something. What are we doing? We're doing nothing.
Yeah.
And they God, go and they so, blow it up. That's slap in his face, man.
And it's so evocative, the first emperor welcoming everyone to his peace in this ruined, you know, this corrupted hologram still saying everything's okay, everything's cool, right as his predecessors blow him up. It's like, and it's also like, it's an ironic sense of peace, kind of like in the way I think Neil Armstrong described the moon as a magnificent desolation. Like, it's kind of like, it's peace because it's the peace of the tomb. Yeah. This thing is just dead and inert. I thought that stuff was really, again, great multi-level storytelling. Don't ever stop and like, you know, comment on this shit. It's just there for you to appreciate.
Yeah. And then I couldn't help but think about Demerzel in this scene also, because she was there when this thing was created. She knew what it meant to Cleon the First. And here it is, his legacy destroying his legacy, ironically.
Swept under the rug. Yeah.
Yeah.
One more dawn day dust cycle and no one will even remember it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although I will hold open that they'll build another space elevator in the form of Cleon the 14th, given two golden platinum fingers to the whole universe. Like that's the spaceport's the tip of his middle fingers.
Sure.
They might do that.
They might. Brother Dusk goes to the cloning facility where he sees Demerzel singing to the new Brother Dawn that's being incubated. He's not supposed to be there, so Demerzel sends him away, and he goes to the new Brother Dawn's room in the nursery and paints a mural above his crib, and then he sleeps, and Demerzel takes him to his bed.
This is good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I have questions, though. Like, why can't... I think they're hinting at an answer. I don't think it's, like, fully answered why... They institute a policy that they can't go see the older Cleons, can't go see the younger Cleons being cloned. And there's something about him calling it unnatural that makes me think maybe there would be one of these clones might get the idea that they need to put an end to the line.
I thought all of these scenes dealing with the new Brother Dawn were dripping with menace because I couldn't help but think that old man's got a disintegrator. Or Lee Pace is just going to play drop the fucking bait like that. This one's bad. This one's not a good one. Drop it on the floor. Yeah. And it didn't, but it shows just how kind of like fragile it all is. Mm-hmm. Because I imagine any emperor could probably order a death squad down there to shoot up the facility and that'd be it. Do they? It's just a way to tradition. It's kind of scary when there's nothing stopping great men and women from really fucking up shit, except for tradition and handshake deals and things like that. Mm-hmm. But man,
unspoken,
a lot of
spoken unwritten rules,
unwritten rules of decorum and stuff. And I, part of the shock of the last decade or so is realizing how much of our own civilization just rests on those kind of things. It's right. Like agreements to like play nice and do things.
It's also a sad scene for Demerzel, you know, thinking about how much she liked Cleon the First and how she has to sort of relive his death every 30 years or so.
You guys always leave me.
Yeah. And you know, the Cleon here, this that Brother Dusk is lamenting, or I guess it's not, it's Cleon the First at the beginning of this episode lamenting that he's going to die and saying, oh, you'll never know death. But she knows his death. She knows it intimately. She's seen it over and over and over again. And yeah, she might not ever, you know, fear death coming too soon. But at the same time, she has this tragedy that she has to relive over and over, right? It's yeah. A different kind of hell.
Yeah, I also thought there's it's really evocative filmmaking here, too. There's like these overhead shots of the Emperor in his like ghostly white gown with this like ghostly white source walking through these darkened hallways at night. And they're talking about the ghosts that haunt you. And I kept on thinking that like Brother Dusk seems increasingly to be like that to the royal family. He's the one that's always being like, you're going to regret this. And you think you can control everything and you can't. And I thought it was, he looks like a literal ghost doing this. And then also if you want another, you know, bean to move over into the, is Demerzel evil? The fact that she is singing to the emperors and they don't know this particular song or what, I feel like it's a hinting of like what other subtle manipulations, what other insidious things might she be weaving into their being raised that they're not aware of, you know, like, are they,
yeah,
like that, like little nugget of wisdom she imparted to Brother Dawn last episode about like, you always choose. Is that true? Or is that something she's telling them to influence? None of the other brothers are there to be like, what the fuck? That's not, no, we don't do this all. I think it's interesting. I feel like, yeah, Demerzel, if not evil, not serving the Empire the way you would conventionally understand it.
That's the thing. I felt very Westworld in this scene. You've got, you know, it's not exactly the same thing, a clone and a robot, not even close, but like, The imagery is very similar of creation and this, you know, sci-fi center here. And then you've got Demerzel saying things that, you know, are meant to be, doing things that are meant to be beautiful, right? And they're like, she's comforting this child. I didn't know you did this. I didn't know you cared that much. Like, this is why we put you in charge of the empire, and then this could also be masking something, right? This could be the double talk. This could be the show's double talk. It's not even the character saying something that could be taken two ways. It's the tone, the feel of the show. And yeah, I remember them doing that several times in Westworld and feeling like they were doing something similar here. I could be totally wrong though.
No, I definitely pick up on it too.
And then there's the mural that Brother Dusk goes and paints above Brother Dawn's crib here, which is very much reinforcing that motif, the theme of creation versus destruction or stagnation. And if you look at it, it's, you know, the Cleon sort of lifting something up into the heavens, right?
That's
the act
Brother
of creation.
Brother Darkness's brothers, they're there uplifting. Yeah, and I think that's right. What was your interpretation of the meaning of it?
I think he's trying to inspire the new Brother Dawn to create something, right? To do something beyond the stagnation that they've been doing for the last 14 generations.
And I thought also as a reminder of his brothers to keep their promise about this gift, you know, like look at them uplifting. They're also uplifting. I think you're supposed to understand that that is something greater than themselves. It's also Brother Dawn, you know, like all working together to, like you said, create something. So, yeah. And of course, 19 years later, some punk is going to just erase it because fuck it.
Yeah.
So, wah, wah.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see more about how that turn happened.
I can't wait, and we're going to get it too, I guarantee you.
Yeah, it's going to be some good shit from Lee Pace, I'm sure.
It's too bad because like the time being a character, some of me thinks that this would work better if the Foundation stuff are interleaved with the Empire stuff a bit more. But it's just hard to do. Like, yeah, there's only so many time jumps. Like, if you had to keep on going, like, this is 20 years before, this is night, this is 35 years. No, this is 19. It'd be uber fucked. But it does make these very, it feels like the Lord of the Rings series, where it's like each book is actually two separate books. And I was always, I don't know about everyone else, but I was always a little bit more invested in one book than the other. And like having to go a whole fucking book to get back to the good stuff, quote unquote, I always found tough. And I feel like when I was reading some of the reviews of this episode, there's people like, oh, clearly the Empire stuff's more interesting. It should be called Empire. And I found, I'm like, okay, we'll settle
give
down.
It time.
But also,
right,
sometimes it's going to be like that, you know?
Yeah. I promise you the Foundation stuff will get more interesting. But yeah, right now, yeah, the Empire is fascinating. So Cleon wakes the next morning, puts on his new clothes. Is there an Emperor's New Clothes reference here? Anywhere? Is that what's happening?
One of the Klingons is going to be brave enough to just go full buck naked. You know?
Sure. I mean, he almost did this episode.
It's the way I came into the world. It's the way I'm leaving. Nah, yeah. I don't need the spandex thongs. Just put me out there.
He christens, without the religious connotations of that word, he christens the new brothers Dawn, Day, and Dusk, and then becomes, I guess, Brother Darkness himself, and walks into a disintegration chamber. And they take the baby over and they mark it with his remains, and Brother Day takes it to its crib.
Yeah, it's a great scene because it's just a really beautiful way to hand everybody. It felt like cogs clicking forward, like, you know, everyone saying, yep, you're Brother Dusk now and you're Brother Day. And oh, look at you, Dawn. And now I'm Darkness. And
is there anything menacing in the hand on the back ushering Darkness into the disintegration chamber? They use that image twice, right, in this episode.
And they made this point in the official podcast that like Demerzel is strong enough to just effortlessly pick this old man up and carry him like a child.
Fair.
That they showed in the previous scene. So like entirely possible that that this always happens. Like I'm not sure what I believe, because I could also believe that this is a unique inflection point, that the old Emperor is going into a disintegrator uneasy. I could also believe that every one of these fuckers went into the disintegrator uneasy, including the first one that was just entrusting it to a child, you know? So but the fact that like when she puts her, that's a bar of iron. You know, like you're getting on a roller coaster and the lap bar is just descended. You're not getting like, and also the disintegration chamber is just so nakedly menacing. Like it's hissing and snapping and it looks like it's going, even though, and the music is at such an odds to it. I hate to say, but I fucking loved all this shit. It's so good.
It's not even just like the idea of the strength, the potential strength of Demerzel, being this iron, you know, device pushing you toward your death. It's also the metaphor of the control that she has, right, over not just this one man right now standing in front of his death, but the entire Empire.
You gonna cry? You gonna be the first Empire to cry? You want to be clear? Yeah,
we can change that painter thing.
Oh, you don't like painter? You want crier, baby? Oh, you want to cry? Don't be disintegrated. Yeah, no, I totally got that they are all kind of like jockeying for her attention and approval. Like she's like their universal mother, and maybe intentionally so. So I'm glad that we both are picking up on this stuff. And then I also thought that I actually thought that was going to like carbon freeze them, like the first guy, like there's going to be like a hall of Emperors that are like frozen in the glass stuff. And no, he just got fucking vaporized. And then they ashed the baby's forehead. Oh, I just thought that was great. I thought this whole thing is just so fucking cool.
Let me ask you this. The hall of Emperors or whatever it's called. Do you think that those Emperors, the busts of those Emperors that sort of materialize are made of their remains?
Oh my God. I thought that's what you're going for halfway through your sentence. And I fully I fully endorse that as headcanon.
Okay,
yeah. The part,
cool.
The Chroma Sands are made out of their dust. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's 100%. That's fucking metal, man.
But, it is cool. And I just like, man, I like the lore and the world building almost more than I like stories. Like the lore will keep me into things like fucking Magic the Gathering, Warhammer, way past like the stories not making sense or whatever. And I feel like that's the most freest creative in terms of fantasy and science fiction when you're just building a world. Because like as soon as you add a story, fuck, you got a plot. You have to make it make sense. You have to have reasonable motivations for people to do. But like when you're just like saying, yeah, old man gets incinerated and the robot goes and spreads ashes on the baby. Like what? Because that's the fucking way they do it, man. Back off. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's the tradition. What do you want?
Yeah, like, do we do crazy shit? There's just so many crazy funerary customs in our little planet.
We're grabbing that baby and we're cutting its dick. So I don't want to hear about the ashes on its head.
Yeah, yeah. I fucking it's the purest form of science fiction fantasy creativity, and this show's got it in spades.
Yeah. There was a nice ironic, or it's not ironic. I don't know what it is. I don't know what to call it, but there's a nice line here where says the dream lives on in you because you kept it alive in you, which is literally true in this instance with all these clones. And it gives you a sense of, you know, what they're trying to do with the education of the nucleons and all that stuff. So thought that was neat. And then 17 years later, Brother Dawn has the mural that Brother Darkness painted erased.
And I like how Gale's talking about the ghosts and being haunted by prophets. And there's this stubborn speck that can't be removed from the wall. And they zoom in, it becomes the son of Terminus.
Yeah.
It's a great way to connect the two episodes. Like the Empire is very much burying its head in the sand. And here we're out to see what the sand is getting up to. I like it.
Yeah. And then some of the words she uses, we're haunted by prophets all. We ignore the dead at our peril. I mean, she's referring to Harry Seldon here, but also I think Brother Dusk or Brother Darkness, as we know him now.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that. All right. Then they begin colonizing Terminus. We're in the second half of the episode now. Apparently, Harry predicted all the exile stuff that would happen, and not just that he'd be exiled, but where he'd be exiled. So he left things for them, I guess, is what they said in this episode, on Terminus, and kind of had everything just so that he knew where they'd land, all that stuff. So they try to approach the vault, but they're unable due to the field around it. And legends about it start to proliferate in the colony as they build up around it or near it, I'd say. Salvor is apparently the daughter of some of the colonists here, one of which is Clark Peters. And I fucking knew his gray hair would show up. I knew it. As soon as I saw that dark ass beard, I was like, he's going to be around for a while.
Gonna wash the shoe polish out. Yeah.
Yep. And they talk, Clark Peters and his wife in this talk about Salvor's personality and fascination with the vault, and Salvor's kind of questioning what the vault is.
Yeah, I think so. There's a couple things where I was trying to decide if this made logical sense. Like, you know, that the Seldonites have spent a long time on the way to this, running calculations, doing simulations, trying to find the ideal landing spot. And they get there and there's an unexplained artifact that projects an anti-life field.
Mm-hmm.
Do these scientists modify their plans to like go to the other side of the planet, or do they just have enough faith in what the work that they've done that they're like, well, fuck it. This thing, like, it just felt like maybe borderline unreasonable that they shacked that close to it. But
I feel you.
I think you got to have to go that like, hey, there's, you know, Harry said to build it here and we did a lot of simulations. Like, what are we going to do? We're going to like throw away all our rehearsing and just because we're afraid of this inert thing. I think it's fine. It's one of the things I raised my eyebrows at. I wish we could have seen a little bit of the debate about what to do about this, but they don't have time for that. They're colonizing this shit.
Yeah, and I think it's telling what Clark Peters says when they approach the vault. He says when he sees it for the first time, "What in Seldon's name is that?"
Yeah.
And that is a very specific phrase, right? That is, we would liken it to what in God's name is that, right?
Yeah.
It's showing that Harry Seldon is, they are deifying this guy. He is becoming a prophet. He's becoming something larger than just a man to them. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons that they stick around is because, well, Harry Seldon, the prophet, is not going to be wrong about where he was taking us, right?
And maybe he needed that because we talked about him like I think the tone of my conversation last week is like he's trying to steer people away from like, oh, I wasn't even supposed to be here. They're going to make me to a god. Maybe the opposite. Maybe he had to be martyred to kick the religious fervor into high gear.
It's a very Harry Seldon move.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious to see us find out more about that. Because like I said, the guy, I'm listening to an official podcast, and he's promising answers for everything in the fullness of time.
Okay.
So we're going to see if he's a lost Damon Lindelof or if he is a leftovers Damon Lindelof. Although... Notably, the leftovers Lindelof did not promise shit.
Yeah.
In fact, he said, "I ain't going to answer shit. It's not about that." So, like, I'm a little nervous, little nervous about that statement.
Another thing that someone says that I liked that says a lot, without actually saying it, is the way that, let's say Salvor's mother. I don't know her name. I don't know if it's ever said either in this episode. But Salvor's mother, I think, describes when Mrs. she's talking Hartnell. About the Empire or the Emperor, she calls them the Kleons. She doesn't say the Empire. She doesn't say the Emperor. She calls them the Kleons, which to me is sort of the opposite of what in Seldon's name is that, right?
It's, you're right. You're
it's
right.
A reduction in power, reduction in respect.
Mortalizing them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was interesting to me.
I saw this interesting post on the Foundation TV subreddit where they talked about, part of this is about the fall and decline of the Roman Empire. It's what some of this stuff is based on. And they talked about the Byzantine periods of iconoclasm. There you go. Jesus. Where like different regimes would say, hey, you know what? No more idols and images of past emperors and saints, and just burn all that shit down, tear it down, because they were wanting to go in it. And they were essentially just literally destroying their own history and heritage to like do something new. And I couldn't help but think about that when I was looking at the Klingon the 14th, like burning his mural down, and Miss Harden here saying, yeah, like decanifying the Kleons. Mm-hmm. It's a social program, both working their hardest to try to undermine the other.
Yeah, for sure. And then we go to now, which is now. Salvor approaches the vault with a bug in her hand. It's apparently knocked unconscious, but she's unaffected. She's just doing experiments here.
Yeah, yeah.
I have in my notes, what does now even mean? But we talked about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Out near the colony, Salvor messes with a field generator that's part of the fence that they apparently have protecting their colony. He asks, he being her father, asks why she's out here. She tells him about the test and that something's wrong with the null field, she says. And then he tells her to take it to her, which we find out is her mother later.
I also thought in retrospect, there's some interesting like foreshadowing of what's to happen. Like, it seems unusual that this large of a bishop claw would be moved to provoke to start testing the town's perimeter all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like it's because his territory is being taken over by the Arachnians coming at the end.
Anacreons?
Yeah. Anacreons are coming at the end. So I thought that's like when I was watching, I'm like, oh, this is kind of clever because you've got this animal acting unnaturally. And it's because it's being driven out of its lair.
Yeah. And then we go to the Foundation Council debating the merits of a water clock versus sundial. There's some. This is a teaching moment for Salvor's mother. After the meeting.
I got to say, I like what they're trying to do here, but I found this the goddamn stupidest conversation, and it made me hate her mother. Like,
what
happens when the water runs out? Well, then all the fucking people die. If you can't scrape together enough water to run a clock, you're not going to be able. I hate to tell you what the water usage of people is, lady. Like, it's just the stupidest fucking. Like, what about the planets that don't have regular solar cycles? And what about the planets that have two or three suns? And what about like this? This is the type of interesting thing they could have a conversation about. But like, come on. She was maximum preachy asshole about it too. I didn't not like this character's introduction.
Okay, I feel you. Yeah, I was thinking something was up here too. And also, it's the second time they've done one of these you know, right. I got it the first time with the math stuff and the hexadecimal versus the binary versus, you know, decimal system, all that. I assume they're going to continue to do this with the colony to show the deeper thinking, you know, the level that they're on, but
the precision versus the practicality, that's all good. But like, I just feel like this is the worst example they could have used. And the person, the thing is I think they're trying to show that she is a little bit of a closed-minded thinker in opposition to her daughter. But like they hit the retro boosters on that way too much. Like she's skipping off the atmosphere of, you know, skeptic and like, you know, closed-minded and entered into just being obnoxious. Oh my God. Maybe it's just me though.
I was wondering why they can't preserve more, why they can't maybe draw a picture and a rough concept of how a water clock would work, even if they're going to go the sundial route.
Sure. And maybe have like a chronology of like, hey, you start with the sundial, then you go to the water clock. Boy, as soon as you get a metallurgy, I'm going to blow your mind. Check out this gears and springs shit you're going to get up to. Like, and then also here's the end game quartz, baby. It vibrates at a certain frequency. Like, seriously? Like something as important as keeping time and
you
measuring
just
things.
Grab every record of the patent office and be like 80% of the way toward capturing humans' knowledge of invention.
It's
kind of
like saying, like, what do we need more, the meter or the liter? We can only keep one. They can either know how long things are, how much volume it occupies. There's no possible way we could, like, get the fuck out of here.
but then I thought about stuff that's more complex, right? Like, I don't know. They're much famed nuclear technology. That could take a while to fully explain the intricacies of to someone who is some kind of primitive who wouldn't understand even the most basic parts of it.
Right. Or the temptation to skip like any kind of like fossil fuel or combustion technology to go right to nuclear. But like maybe you have to have a transit. But like I think that would have been a fascinating debate, like impacts on the environment and like being complacent versus like pushing towards nuclear and solar and things like that. That'd have been an interesting conversation. Water clocks versus sundials didn't quite do it for me.
Gotcha. After the meeting, Salvor and her mother walk and talk about her role in the Foundation and what it could have been versus what she wants and what she's best suited for, which are two very different things, apparently. I couldn't help but notice this opening shot when we come down to the council in their chambers. There's an external, you know, establishing shot of a statue of Harry Seldon and the building that they're in, and it's very reminiscent of the Empire's stuff, right? Even the shape of, and I mean, it probably would be, they all come from this society that their architecture wouldn't change overnight, right? But it evoked like this image of, oh, okay, this is not just some offshoot project thing, but this is almost maybe a direct challenge to the Empire, right? If you're deifying and making statues of Harry Seldon, this is going to be big.
Yeah, it does seem like that. I also thought that central raised building might have been their shuttle, like landed on its engines, and that was like the core of the city. So I wasn't sure how much of it is like deliberately ostentatious architecture or just like the administrative buildings were the most important thing and everything grew out from that.
Well, but they did take parts, right? They cannibalized the slow ship to build their city.
Yeah.
So yeah, they might be literally. Then we have Salvor takes her mother out to the vault and tells her that the null field is expanding, and so she tests it for herself. Yes, it's true. She talks about the first time she found her here, standing right under the vault, and Salvor said it was calling to her, and her mother couldn't reach her. Her family kind of knows that she's special, but they're keeping it a secret. Nobody else knows that she is unaffected by this null field.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, like, they know something's up with her, though, because she still kind of makes people uncomfortable. And Salvor thinks the vault is waking up and they've been, you know, preparing for this crisis that they've been talking about. And she thinks it's here now.
Render backyard. Yeah, it's interesting that, like, whatever makes her stand apart from the colonist is entirely separate from her specialness about the null field. Like there's something about her that's off-putting or maybe causes her to be distant. Maybe it's related to the immunity, but like she keeps herself distant she likes to be out in patrol. She likes to be up when everyone else is sleeping, holding everybody. So it's not like everyone knows that she's a freak and are treating her thus. It's like she does somehow hold herself a little bit apart, to the extent that it annoys people.
Yeah. It annoys her mother too. I think she wanted something else for her.
Water clocks, but she could only give her sundials.
Yeah. So then some kids run to a landing ship to meet a guy named Hugo, and he comes out of the ship and tells him he can give them some stuff, something better than chocolates or whatever, if they help him unload his ship. And you get the impression that he's a traitor, right? Like he's out visiting other colonies, bringing things back.
Yeah, and they built this guy up as like a cool dude. Like all the kids are like, oh, Hugo's here. Hugo's like Gandalf coming to the Shire, right?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And it kind of lives up to it. I like, I've looked this guy up. He's an Australian actor. He's done a couple things that I've not actually seen. I will say that I don't think they did a very good job of selling the eyeballs. Like the other thespians had intense, like Dune Navigator blue eyes. And this guy's just got kind of like mild, like Dreamboat blue eyes. I thought they were, I kind of am confused about how fucking blue the thespian eyes are supposed to be, because
yeah,
I don't know. Is he like he's a more believable thespian shade. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe he's they're going to find that out, because like there's got to be something, because everybody else had like, am I crazy or did all the other thespians have like glowing blue eyes?
Well, he also mentioned something about like hiding, you know, disguising his identity a bit too. Right. So maybe he's intentionally doing something to reduce the blue.
There could be some mystery here. Yeah. Yeah. But I also like the other thing I thought was hilarious is there's an extra that tries to corral these kids who has no fucking clue how to act like a person that's corralling kids. He's just like miming in open space, man. Kids are like, it's every time I notice this guy just got like trying to play imaginary goalie to these kids. This is hilarious. I highly recommend checking it out on a rewatch.
Yeah. So then Hugo is cooking for Salvor in her house. Get the feeling that they are very familiar with each other. Apparently he's only here for 29 hours and they use that time to go out and view the other planets he's traveled to as he tells her stories of what's out there. And then asks her to leave. Well, doesn't ask her to leave with him, but kind of suggests it. And then she doesn't have exact reasons, but she can't leave, she says. And afterward, they make love.
I thought this is what I was talking about like the outer reaches seem to be invigorated by the partial collapse of the empire pulling out, because like instead of again, a disinterested empire kind of lazily doing like now they're free to like set up their own thing and like it's bustling. Like he's talking about like, you know, the streets just lined with gold out there. Just go out and pick it up. You got all these mutually beneficial trade arrangements and it's not decaying and declining. There is a lot of growth and creativity out here where the empire's light isn't touching. I thought that was interesting. It's in the margins of storytelling, but they're telling it.
Yeah.
Seems like trade is going to be really important in the future to this outpost. It already is.
Yeah, I imagine we'll see more of Hugo. Probably like
I want to see that world that has so many moons. I always thought that'd be cool to fucking live on like a moon of Jupiter, and there's like 69 other moons that you could identify woven around. That'd be fucking sweet, right?
Yeah,
we got a lot of good things on Earth. I like the breathable atmosphere, the abundance of liquid water, but we really got jobbed on the whole satellite. It's just the one big one, really. Okay,
it's true. We should build some of our own.
No rings. Can't have a ring system. How dope would that be?
Be pretty sweet.
Again, like the breathing, like the one bar atmosphere at the surface, but man, the visuals really skimped out.
All right, Salvor wakes up later that night because she got a weird feeling. She gets out of bed and she goes to walk the perimeter, and she sees a child running toward the remains of the slow ship. She chases him inside and eventually spots both a bishop's claw, I think, is what this thing is. It has claws. I don't know. And then an Anacreon ship descending toward the surface. And she runs back to the colony and shows Hugo the ship, and they alert the Foundation.
Something that wasn't revealed in the simulations are how big a pussy these bishop's claws are. They're not No, they just kind of fire in the air and they just run off, you know, like, and shows them intimidation. She is not afraid of them. I mean, by the end of the episode whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. And yeah, it's cool way to introduce the new primary antagonist, like just to see the drive flume coming at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool.
Plume.
And I like the sense of scale here. I don't know how slow these slow ships are, but they're coming down real slow, right? They've got like 2 days or something before the ship even lands. But yeah, maybe we should get over the council stuff because I'll talk more about this. The council debates what to do about the Anacreon gunships descending despite the Imperial edict that the Terminus is off limits. Salvora tells them about the changes to the vault and tries to connect the two things, but she doesn't have any real conclusions. So the council decides, hey, we're just going to call the Empire for help. And Salvor goes to the armory to try and prepare a defense should the Empire not help them.
Yeah.
Or really, I don't even know what the Empire could do at such short notice, but.
Right. Well, I mean, they do have the jump drives, which as far as I can tell is instantaneous travel.
That's true.
So they probably do a lot. It's just, again, like, are they limited by their power or their political will at this point? Maybe a little bit of both at this point. But there's a lot of other details, like Hugo, even though he looks like he's like in the prime late 20s, early 30s, he's actually over 70 years old because of different time dilation and cryo sleep concerns. I thought that was kind of neat. And
is
also
setting
just like
up future stuff. Is that setting up stuff with Gale? So that when we see Gale next time,
I
and it's
think
five,
it might be,
you know, 50 years in the future, and she looks the same.
And she's still, I think that's actually a really smart take. I was just thinking of like they're trying to show different ways that like slow ships could work. Because I, on the official podcast last week, they talked about how their idea of a slow ship is something that travels slower than light, but navigates through a system of predetermined gates. Like there are stargates that might jump you 5,000 years, and you have to travel 6 months of sublight. Kind of like getting off of an interstate, driving through the city, worming your way through the back roads, getting back onto another interstate.
Yeah.
So like it's like you do huge stretches of the trips in just seconds. But to get to those pre-stage interstellar highways, you have to drive. That's why it took like 20 years, you know, it took like 20 years of drive, like 19 years to go 1% of the way. And the others happened. So I also think it's another just kind of casual world building, but it probably will come in to Gale's story as well. Yeah,
I would think so. So our family helps Salvor prepare a defense. The weapons apparently aren't well maintained because they've never really needed them. The Foundation tries to call the Empire, but they can't get a signal out. Apparently the Anacreons will be here in 40 hours. So Salvor's mom goes to storage and pulls out the Prime Radiant and shows it to Salvor, and she asks her if she can make anything of it, and I would say she likes what she sees, but she doesn't exactly know, and she can interact with it and spin it around, but she doesn't know really what it means.
I'm glad that went this way, because I was about to like, if this is going to be like Jurassic Park, this is Unix, I know this, and she just instantly
this is psycho history,
then,
I know this.
Yeah, she's opened up the psycho cube and she's just gonna just intuitively navigate it. Like they already did that with Gale, but she is already a next level mathematician.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So like
sense.
Having her kind of like, oh yeah, this kind of, no, it doesn't make sense.
It wasn't intuition or like some genetic predisposition toward psychohistory.
Right.
Yeah, that was learned and studied.
And I thought they were, and I'm like, oh God, they're shortcutting a little too much if they're going to do that. But no, so thank God.
There's still the possibility that, you know, whatever affinity she has for this thing is tied into what makes her special beyond just, you know, the null field stuff.
Oh, 100%.
I think she is like they're very much denying. She wants to deny it this whole episode. Look, I'm unique. I'm different. But that just makes me different, not special. I still think she is special. And we'll see why later, I assume. But for now, they're not just going to jump right into that.
And I think there's a lot of this. We'll get into this more in feedback. There's a lot of people drawing conclusions from embryos being withdrawn and ages of characters and starting to line up like, oh, could this be the child of this person or perhaps this person? I mean, I don't think anyone can say for certain, but like, yeah, there is something. I also wonder if their parents have done her a service by keeping this under wraps, because like she said a whole bunch of stuff at this council meeting that the other counselors just took as like just delusion. But if they knew that she was like immune to the null field, maybe you sit up and take a little bit of notice of the person speculating on the artifact trying to protect or warn you, you know?
Yeah. I was trying to track like the disposition of this Prime Radiant. Because wasn't Gale given the Prime Radiant last episode, but then she got jettisoned from the ship, presumably without it. Oh my God.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I don't think she had that in her pocket.
It's either in her office or Harry's at office, and neither one of those were occupying it at the end of last episode. So,
And they do explain, I think they explain it in this episode where her mother took, she says she took it from Harry Seldon's office the night after his funeral. So it must have been like almost immediately after what we saw.
Yeah, but you do wonder if there's like any alterations or changes or something, because that's like there's a gap between the night of his funeral and the night he died. And Raish really is still like we have no idea what happened after he shoved her in that tube. Like, was there a trial? Did they shove him out the airlock? Was he able to go back to the quarters and like plug in a few changes into the old Seldon plan? Like, yeah, they have to address that eventually. Have to.
Yeah. And then this Prime Radiant, where it is at any given moment, isn't something Harry really could have predicted. So, like, he doesn't work on those scales. So, I don't know if, like, Salvor connecting with the Radiant is anything that's going to disrupt a plan that's in motion. But we'll see more in the future. So Salvor goes over to Hugo and tells him about the failed comms. She suggests that he leave, and he suggests she leave. Everybody seems to want to leave. want Hugo to leave, and you to leave with Hugo and all that. She has to protect people, so she wants to stay behind. Later that night, she gets out of bed and goes to the vault. She sees the same child running around and chases him into the slow ship again. This time, she finds the bishop's claw with an arrow in its back, and she is surrounded by Anacreons.
Yeah, a whole bunch of advanced scouts apparently just set up right underneath their noses.
Yeah, I mean, did they come from the other side of the planet? Did they just land outside of the view?
I feel like they're advanced scouts because they've been here. Okay. It's like particular how they got there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's going to be interesting to kind of find out, I'm assuming, next episode. And there's also this like key like in Gale's narration where she's like, if you pay attention to the patterns, we can presage what happens next. To be alive is to know ghosts, and we can hear the whispers. I'm wondering what pattern they're alluding to. Like, is there some kind of greater fulfillment of the Emperor's balking at transition of power that's going on in the barbarian kingdoms? Is there need to be a transition in power from the foundation leaders to people who are less like, is this an attempt by Harry to course correct from like, well, I need them to martyr me and kind of be deified, but not that much deified. So you have a generation like Salvor Hardin that said, hey, I didn't know this guy. He ain't nothing to me. Like, do you need something to kind of bring that back? I wonder. That's the thing when that's the biggest question in my mind, or what events are presaging what? What have we seen so far is going to explain to us how the next things are going to happen? I think that's something I'm on the lookout for.
Yeah. It could be as simple as sort of revenge. You know, I mean, if we think back to last episode, the ghosts of the dead are certainly these Anacreons, right? Inhabiting the skeletons that were once our homes, the slow ship. It's all, you know, very literal in this case, too. But then you look at like the patterns of human history, very few times do people turn the other cheek, right? Instead, they'll strike back. And I think that's
right.
It could be part of what they're hinting at here is this is revenge somehow for what the Emperor did.
It's such a weird juxtaposition between a spacefaring civilization and people who just use bow and arrows.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder, you know, it's a concept I've seen before, like, in the Warhammer universe, like there are worlds that are they called feudal or agrarian worlds, where they don't bother to give them technology because they just grow wheat, Your whole planet just grows wheat for a trillion people, and I don't give a shit if you have even indoor plumbing, man. Like, I wonder if there's some of, like, the Emperor's, like, treats these people like they're literally nomads. Like, their technology is, like, below 20th century Earth technology, and they are used for something else. Like, they have some resource that they extract, and the Empire gives them no benefit. But then how do they fly starships? But yeah. It's also a way to, like, you could, like, these are a threat to the Terminus people because they don't have any weapons, but, like, not a threat that would be crazy hard to, you know, like, a little bit of technology and, you know, automatic weapons, and these guys are going to be in some body armor, and then they're pretty much shit out of luck, right? So it's interesting scaling of the threat.
And I think it sets us up for a more exciting future for what's happening on Terminus. I think up until now, it's been a lot of setup, and with the introduction of some, you know, drama or friction here, it's going to be a lot more interesting to see what happens on Terminus going forward and with the Foundation.
I agree. And also, the other thing is, I don't know if these bows are literally bows, or maybe they're like Wookiee bowcasters or like laser bows.
Sure.
And they're like, they just look primitive, but they're actually highly sophisticated and advanced. Although, I guess that Bishop's Claw had a real ass arrow stuck in it.
Yeah, so it's a bow with a laser sight.
If they're plasma arrows, they're not doing a great job, because you can just pull them out of a weird spider cat.
Yeah, that's the episode.
Yeah, well, we have quite a large feedback. A lot of people want to talk about the show, it turns out, Jim. If you like to add to it, it's foundation@baldmove.com. That's how you get considered for show feedback. Like I said, we got a bunch. So, in fact, we might have so much that we, like Walking Dead, split this off from the main podcast, because Jim and I took a 50-minute episode and turned it into an hour and a half podcast just by ourselves. We'll let all you guys in. Who knows? 3-hour podcast. That's a lot. We might have to split the feedback off to a later in the week podcast. We'll see. But right now, we'll see what we end up. Oh, also, Jim and I had a little sidebar before we recorded about book spoilers, because we got a, more than a smattering, but less than a majority of, like, book spoiler type emails. And Jim has only read the one book. I've read the initial three, but it's been 20 plus years. I think right now we are going to try to go in the rest of the season without any more book spoilers than we've got. And there's, like, you know, so anything that you know from, like, the prequels or the sequels or stuff like that, I'm going to try to filter out. We might course correct in season two. We might decide to do like Game of Thrones and just fuck it, read all the books and try to become an expert and have a separate book spoilers from show, you know, discussion. But right now we're going to go this season. We're just going to, since we have so little, we're going to just go with the show only. All right.
Yeah, I don't know that we could tell what spoilers versus speculation are in the first place, but also I kind of want to watch this show. I'm enjoying the show so much that I don't want to spoil myself too much on it.
Plus, it's hard for me because, like, if I haven't read the books, like, it's hard for me to tell the difference, because, like, people get things wrong. Like, people send me stuff all the time, like in Game of Thrones, where it's like they just remembered something wrong, or they transposed a character in their mind, and I have no way to check that stuff out. On the other hand, I also know that there's some things that are discussed in the feedback that are pretty on the nose. But on the other hand, the show is definitely kind of laying tracks, or, like, they're not saying, oh, because of the books, they're saying, I noticed this, that, and the other. It's a fine line, and in my mind, if you can substantiate your point just using show facts and things that happen in the show, then it's probably something that we're going to read on the show and talk about. If you have to be like, well, I think this is going to happen because in the books, you know, Demerzel had 3 legs and 7 eyeballs, and that's a significant number because in the prequels, there's probably other podcasts that will indulge in that, but not us. Again, we might change our mind, but that's just how we feel right now. So we'll see how it goes. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th,
Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
All right, we're coming back. Foundation at baldmove.com. First up, Bill D says, a space elevator-like conveyance does appear in one of Asimov's expanded works. We talked about me not being familiar with like the concept of space elevator. He says, while Asimov attributed most things to atomics in his first few books, gravitics became the science magic of choice in a later works. Apparently, there's something involving a space elevator and gravitics.
Okay.
During the official podcast for Foundation, David Goyer mentions the slow boat to Terminus. He name checks the ship and its capabilities. It's apparently subluminal, and he claims to have sweat the math on it. They've also had some conversations on Rach's jacket and the costuming department. It's worth a quick listen, probably, though, not as entertaining as your coverage. I actually think the official podcast is great. It doesn't go nearly in as much depth as far as the themes and stuff, but it's good for stuff like this. And like I said, I think that my understanding of it, it's subluminal, but with like jump gates, like interstellar highways, because subluminal, I know the dimensions of the Milky Way galaxy, it's 100,000 light years across. So from the core to the edge, if you take it literally, it's going to be 50,000 light years. That's at least 50,000 year trip, and that did not happen. No. So, there were some jump gates. It's just they don't have the ability to just rip a hole in time and space wherever they're at and go right there instantaneously like the Imperial jump drives do. So thanks for those clarifications and some details, Bill. Moving on to Victoria. I just watched the first two episodes of Foundation and listened to your podcast covering them, and I've had some thoughts on the sequence of events surrounding Harry's death. I think Aaron is right in that it's a Dumbledore-Snape type situation, and it hints in the sense that Harry asked Raish to kill him. I don't know if I believe Harry was already dying from something else, although I did clock the pill thing and the look at dinner between him and Raish too, but thought the pill is probably just one of the million things I have to take to stay alive on the ship, and the look was meant to help build the tension between them.
Nobody else took a pill.
That's the thing. And like, that's I can't disprove that. But like the rebuttal is like, well, this is a movie and everything they show us means something. Yeah. So like if it was just like everybody taking a pill, this is a very fucking weird way to show that. So I still
think your first instinct is right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do think he wanted to die, continuing with Victoria's point, so that the rest of the colony crew could come together and have another concrete reason to follow the plan with renewed religiosity and to deify Seldon. And of course, we know from this episode that shit kind of worked according to plan, apparently.
Yeah.
I think Raish was on the plan from the beginning, but Gale was not. So when she burst in the door before the act was complete, she threw a huge wrench in the plan, which probably included giving Raish time to get away or cover his tracks. I kind of agree with that, although I think Raish knew the plan, and but like her, like when I watched that show again and her like saying that like the numbers were in doubt to some extent, that sent him into a panic. Because it's one thing to like throw stuff away on a sure thing that you believe in. It's another. It's like, oh, what if there's a probability? And now that he's so, because whatever happens, Gale going bye-bye was going to be one of those things. I think he knew he was never going to get all of those nice things that he wanted. He wanted it all with her, right?
Yeah, the Harry Seldon is a martyr, and Raish's penis is a martyr as well.
Yes, Raish took one for the team. Yeah. Following the Harry Potter reference, she would have been like Harry hiding in the astronomy tower, but only if he jumped out before Snape had a chance to take over from Malfoy and some random Death Eater had done the deed in killing Dumbledore. It's very messy, is what she's saying. Basically, she forced Raish to act quickly to get her safety before the Harry Seldon is dead alarm went off, notifying the ship what went down. I think he threw the knife in her with the escape pod because he didn't have time to clean it or hide it after she ran in. I think it's more, man, I wish we knew more about it. I wish there was some oblique reference to the Empire made about, you know, Harry Seldon being gone and by his own people or something like that, to kind of, because we don't have anything to go on that.
Like, we verified the DNA match on the blood or whatever. Yeah.
But also, where the hell is she going? I know you guys mentioned maybe she's on her way back to Trantor, but I didn't really get that vibe that Raish punched any specific coordinates before shooting her off to space. But I guess we'll find out soon enough. Like I said, framing her from Seldon and sending her, like, it made sense to send her to Trantor because, like, that's one way to get her back in good graces with the Empire for some future use. And they already established that there's like some kind of double agent guy who might be able to facilitate that. Maybe he's secretly working for Harry. The other thing is, like, she could just be there. There's a point in this episode where the mother, Mrs. Harden, said there's only two people on that ship that understood this thing I'm holding right now. One is Harry Seldon's dead and the other is Gale, which she inexplicably didn't. But like, it, part of me says that maybe she's in that fucking thing in the stasis chamber. That, like, she's waiting,
the
and they used the, they used the word, they didn't say it's activating, it's turning on, they said it is waking up, which they've already shown her waking up in some other kind of, like, I feel like that's where they're going with this. So she's going to be able to come out and maybe, like, decode the psychohistory for the rest of his adherents. But I don't know why you would do that. I don't know why you wouldn't leave her on the ship.
All right, crazy theory time. Is there any chance that this Anacreon invasion is actually Gale coming to the Foundation with the assistance from the Anacreons?
Holy shit. That could be cool. That she actually soft landed over Anacreon, took the whole place over with psychohistory, and is coming back to like be the muscle.
I don't know that you desperately can need. Accomplish that in 35 years, but maybe.
I mean, they seem like they're well on their way to starting a state religion around Harry Seldon in the same amount of time. And they took the best and brightest from all the scientists, like, you know, presumably secular people that you could gather.
I think that's out there, but it's a possibility.
Interesting. Interesting. I don't know. Well, thanks for your comments, Victoria. We'll see what happens. Jim steps forward with some praise and at least two criticisms that I'm going to try to defend the show from.
Okay.
Says, I am so intrigued with the Empire day dusk cycle. I'm guessing they must be 30 years apart in age. So if you're trained from 0 to 30, you rule from 30 to 60 and provide wise counsel to yourself from 60 to 90, and 90 are killed, another clone, Dawn, is born. It also seems that you learn to be cruel as Dawn, to rule with an iron fist as Day, and then soften as you age into dusk. It's hard roughly to say that for sure, because we saw a singular inflection point and mm-hmm. the destruction of Cleon, the first legacy here. So, like, I don't know. Is the Emperor always, like, you know, clearly they're not big on overthinking the stick and the carrot and the stick metaphor.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say. It does seem like that's part of it, though. Like, you're idealist as the Dawn, you're pragmatic as Day, and then you're back to kind of like, shouldn't we at least find a better way as Dusk?
Which probably is, you know, Asimov and Goyer and everybody trying to say something about humans in general.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, this is an intriguing way to have the same characters exist for millennia. Yeah, I agree. I fucking love this idea. I wonder if it's going to survive the collapse of the Empire, like, or what they'll do once the Empire collapses, how they'll maintain that, you know, antagonist well, succession that's so interesting that they've built up here.
I know we're jumping around like 400 years an episode, so maybe this will happen next episode, but we have at least 500 years, according to psychohistory, before that happens. So I think we'll get a lot more Emperor before then.
On to the criticisms. I think the Sky Bridge was too vulnerable to attack. Two men with internal bombs are able to collapse the entire structure, killing 100 million people. I think the engineers would have designed and constructed a system with redundancies to prevent progressive collapse. If it's not one of the easiest predictions, that it would be someday taken down by terrorists. I think this is true, but also, do you know how much fucking devastation a single person with a battery operated angle grinder could do to the infrastructure of, like, the United States? Like, you can in like 2 minutes take down almost any cell phone tower or communication tower you want. You could take down a good section of high tension power lines and potentially paralyze a region. Why doesn't that happen? Because by and large, people are okay with how things are going. Again, by and large, and there's not enough people. There's not people just tearing shit up for just to watch something burn. We're privileged to have that state of political instability. If we had to heavily militarize our fucking infrastructure and harden it against terrorist attack, our world would look a hell of a lot different. So it's easy to say, just like, it's like, well, fuck, man, how hard was it to predict someone to fly planes into the buildings? It's fucking pretty hard to predict shit like that. And it's not something that we should build our organize our society around. So I don't know. Like, again, yeah, 100, but like with 8 trillion people, what does that even mean? That's like 1,000 people dying. To some, that's a tragedy for sure.
Right.
But yeah, so I that's the other perspective. Like, I think the Empire just thought their Pax Imperial would rule the day and that people would respect and enjoy it.
Yeah. Never overestimate the potential for failure of human ego. And I think the Emperor embodies ego as much as anything else.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like there's just so many areas where we're vulnerable to attack if people wanted to, and it's just that people don't. So
that,
and I think they also did a pretty good job of showing that this was a particular, like, smuggling that substance required some advanced research that's very hard to source and was very careful. Like, because think about like where we're at with like what we know from the Snowden leaks as far as like the kind of intelligence that they gather on our day. Like, imagine what the Empire could do with faster light communication and predictive engines and stuff. It could be that they just can solve most crimes against the state before they happen. And this was just like an unprecedented amount of, like, you know, using proxies and cat's paws and false purchases and false flags to pull it off.
And keystering. So let's not overlook the massive amount of keystering that must have been
so
happening.
So much
there.
Keystering of volatile chemicals to make those little wrist bombs. I thought it was fine. Secondly, he says, I find it completely unbelievable. There's a field of math so complex, only 2 people out of 8 trillion understand it. It takes a far more brilliant mind to discover, develop a field of math than it does to learn it from someone who understands it. Harry should have had dozens of students that were learning the math from him and would be in a good position to test his mathematical model. So, like, I think this is true, but I also think you're misunderstanding what happened in the plot. Harry is a prestigious teacher at a prestigious university of this subject. He has dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of students of this science, but they're all his, like, refer as his acolytes, like the like Harry putting all of his personal students up as like, oh yeah, this is a guy, yeah, like
this is
like,
my this mom is the, and she says I'm very good looking.
Yeah, it's like Socrates calling all of his students to testify why he shouldn't have to drink hemlock. It's like, yeah, okay, can you find someone who's not fucking brainwashed? So having Gail, who is an outsider but it's also a talented mathematician that the Empire felt like they got before Harry got her claws into, even though he was using psychohistory, she was the perfect witness, you know?
Yeah.
That she's got as, yeah, like everything in her being is going to tell her to discredit Harry. If she doesn't, then that's more valuable a testimony. So it's not that like there's not a math, like even Harry says, like, I could explain it to someone. I just need someone that's conversant in probabilistic, you know, mathematical mechanics. So those people are rare. And also sometimes there are parts like when Albert Einstein came up with relativity, there might have only been a handful of people in the whole fucking world in those first few years as he was working out special and general relativity that really could grapple and understand that subject, much less explain it to laymen. And psychohistory is one of those things where it's like, it is a very recent thing. And I don't think there is just tons and tons of people in the galaxy that know about it and engage with it seriously. So I don't know if that helps or if it's just me being apologetic for a show that I'm in the tank for. But Brian R. says, as far as the warden in the 35 plus year timeline, she's got to be Gail's zygote they removed from the ship, right? This timeline seems to add up with the ability for Gail to awaken during the jump in episode one, and it seems related to the ability of the warden to approach the vault and maybe hereditary.
She does have parents, though. Are they biological parents or are they surrogate?
She doesn't remember
parents.
Harry, so there's no fucking way she could remember who she popped out of.
Right.
The other lady who's carrying the space baby to full term is another possibility that something in the the poison milk and the radiation made her superhuman or something. Uh-huh. Although someone pointed out that her conspicuously drinking wine at the meal afterwards was a sign that she had listened to Gail and went ahead and got her embryo yoinked.
Oh, I thought she was just an asshole.
She's like, well, poison milk and radiation. What's the Chardonnay going to do? Glug, glug. Yeah, I guess you could take it that way. But yeah, there's probably something to the star children and being born special. Yeah. As far as the robot nursemaid, she may be trusted by the emperors because she originally installed them and facilitated the whole ongoing clone rule system. Two options for motivation, both based on my theory that she understands psychohistory because, you know, robots and math. She could be the antagonist. What better way to avenge her race's genocide than to manipulate the Empire into 30,000 years of devastation and destruction? She chose him because he would put the Empire on a course for collapse and possibly even mastermind the bombing of the space elevator to accelerate the collapse. That's interesting. I never took her as an active architect for this doom, but she could be.
She could be. I don't think she chose the Cleon, like the first, where to start this cloning thing. I think Cleon chose her. And then maybe it became a thing where now she's, you know, shaping things. But that's just the impression
I get. Did she maneuver events? Did she make sure that Cleon is the one that won the, I guess, power struggles that used to be a big part of the dynasties collapsing and reforming? The other possibility Brian identifies is as a protagonist, she installed the Emperor to create the circumstances to bring Harry Seldon about and arrange for him to learn psychohistory that he might act to shorten those 30,000 years of chaos that she saw coming inevitably a long time ago. It's this scenario where she was the human sympathizer in the war, echoing Harry's thoughts of, you know, there's always a sympathizer, even the most embittered last android left.
It's interesting. We've said stuff about robots and Asimov's work and specifically in Foundation. I don't know how accurate it is. I've only read the first book. That would make the robot the main character of Foundation, the main protagonist of Foundation. I don't know that that's where they're going with it. But
and
that
even
would
if
be
it's
the
not
effect
in the books,
of that.
it's not, it wouldn't be a crazy idea to do it on the show. You know, we talked about like just like Star Wars, C-3PO and R2-D2 are the they're not the main protagonists, but they're the continuity throughout the series. You know, just this robot can do that because they don't ever age and et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah, we'll they also don't manipulate the plot very much where, you know, in this scenario, Demerzel would be the main protagonist. And I'm not saying they won't do it. I'm just saying that would be different from my experience with that first book, certainly.
All right, let's move on to Alex E. Says, I was a little disappointed in the lack of explanation for Harry's death that we're given in the first several episodes. I'm fine with skipping over to early relationship details of Raish and Gale because everybody's familiar with that human experience. But I feel like we're owed a little more setup to go from Harry gets details about Raish's father wrong, yada, 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 that Raish murders Harry in cold blood. I assume we're going to get some retconning in the next few episodes to fill in some of the blanks, but it feels like a mark of a poor show. One of the things that made Game of Thrones great was when a central character was unexpectedly killed. It always had a reason it made sense. Everyone was surprised when Ned Stark was killed because he's the hero, and yet nobody was surprised because it made sense narratively. The way Foundation handled Harry's death seems more like a tropey trick to keep you coming back next week, the kind of the network television uses a lot. How do you guys feel about the way they handle the reveal and any concerns with long plot lines that the show will continue to skip over the narrative details thereof?
I'm fine with it. Keep in mind, this is the first episode, right? This is all set up. None of this stuff is like.
Yes.
I don't know. I guess I don't feel the same way about something that happens in episode one to set up future events versus something that happens at the end of the season as like a big event. So that's how I'm looking at it. What do you think?
I think so, too. I think that we've said this a bunch on other podcasts, like there's a bad way to do things and there's a good way to do things. There's a bad way they handle time skips and ones that are just pointless and are confusing for the sake of confusing and to hide shitty plot lines or to hide how kind of straightforward and hackneyed a plot line is by chopping it up and doing it in a certain order that you can like, you know, like my preference is tells things in chronological order, play with all your cards face up and, you know, see where see where everything falls, you know. On the other hand, if you do it well, like who complains that Quentin Tarantino didn't tell a sequential story in Pulp Fiction? You know, he got a particular effect because our affections and feelings with people are established in different points of time. And so like what may be the protagonist in one scene is the antagonist in the next. And like that gets a different feeling, evokes a different sensation from the viewer. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know. It's too early to see if this stuff is because like I'll be fine at the end of the season and be like, you know what? This is a pretty vanilla plot and Goyer gussied it up with a bunch of time jumps and stuff to hide from the fact. I'll say that if it's that's what it turns out to be. But like it's just like Jim said, it's too early. Can be the hallmarks of a shitty show. Like this could be like Ryan Murphy just being lazy on American Horror Story, or it could be them telling a very tough story that spans 1,000 years and has 17 dozen characters in it, you know, and we've never seen something like this on television before. So there's no template for it.
Yeah, and there could be mistakes made during that process, but there could also be I do think we will get more information. They're not just going to leave that hanging there. I mean, Raish is a big question mark at this point. And I will be disappointed if we get significantly into this first season, maybe toward the end, and we haven't learned anything more about that.
Right.
Because I do think it would be a mistake. But for now, I'm just kind of letting the mystery be.
Betting on the leftovers, Lindelof, eh?
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on to Allie. Hey, guys, it seems like Gale's brief time spent awake during her initial journey has caused some kind of disruption to her experience of space-time with her mind and body being on quote-unquote different trips. In both episodes, she seems to comment on significant events before they occur. And at first, she notes that there's something wrong with the Star Bridge before the attacks, in the same sense that she sensed that something was wrong before Harry was killed in episode 2. Well, I haven't gone back to time it. The differential seems roughly on par with the duration of the scene in which she wakes up, implying that her mind skipped ahead when this happened. I don't know if it's like you can set your watch by it that way, but it is. She does seem to have I don't know, maybe it's and they hit it a little. I don't think we talked about the fact that she realized she got a prime wrong. She calculated a prime wrong, and then that mm-hmm. caused her to like reevaluate her calculations, which I don't think she it's tough to say whether she actually saw that something was wrong or she was just like concerned about her calculations and went back to check them. And Harry's being murdered in the Time Cube office, you know. But the Star Bridge, for sure, there's something about her having a sixth sense, maybe.
Are they connecting her with Salvor at all? Because Salvor's doing similar things, right? Having premonitions, but something is wrong feelings while laying in bed and getting up. And
they were both identified by their loved ones and their mothers, in this case, as being special.
Yeah.
Not just unique, but like, you know, special for a special purpose. So mm-hmm. I think they are definitely drawing a conclusion, and I think that maybe some of the zygote theories have some legs here. Allie continues and says, "This is an interesting counterpoint, if so, to Selden's predictive ability. Both are impressionistic programs with some degree of uncertainty, are clearest around events of particular significance, and make similarly monkey paw-esque in their limited ability to influence the outcomes of what they can predict. Hers because there's not enough time, his because there's too much of it. They effectively function as near and far-sighted versions of seeing the future." It'll be interesting to see how the show plays with that. It's also, the other thing is, like, Harry's is probabilistic, mathematic, over large scales. Her seems to be very intuitive and actions of an individual. Like, Harry couldn't predict the bombing of the Star Bridge. She sensed something was wrong. Harry thought he would die before he got on the ship, but she knew that there was some... So yeah, you're right. It's like looking at two different ends of the telescope, kind of.
It's one of the main things I love about this show so far is they are doing that in almost every regard. They're you know, the idea of a clone is longevity and continuity, but it's also being myopic and stagnation, right? There are multiple elements to all of the features of this universe that they're looking through both ends of that.
Yeah, and as Allie points out in her conclusion, the other thing is, like, she is from a descendant of seers, like people that claim to be able to see the future. Now, we don't know if that's if that's like religion in the sense that astrology is religion, mm-hmm. But or if that's like religion in the sense that, like, Game of Thrones, like, when, you know, there's actually real shit, you know, real forces that we don't understand moving.
It would be ironic
that complicates it.
The religion that she comes from can't actually see the future or predict anything. And she rejects that and thereby ends up in some space quantum bullshit that separates her mind from her body, and she can now see into the future. There's like an irony to rejecting the thing you thought would give you that ability and then ending up with it mm-hmm. anyway.
Sarah mentions, "Hey guys, if you're interested in riding a space elevator, you can just head to Disney World. The entire premise of the newly opened Space 220 restaurant at Epcot is that the base is 220 miles above the Earth. Diners ride a space elevator to get to the dining room. Love your pod. Keep up the great work."
Right, and cool.
It is cool.
I have to say, I love the shit that Disney does with their experiences and rides and stuff.
Oh, yeah. The theming, yeah.
But it is also hilarious at the same time. Like, oh, we took a 2-minute elevator 220 miles up.
We talked about this on lunch a couple weeks ago, and I guess I misunderstood because I thought you were essentially boarding a shuttle that flew up to the space station. If it's actually a space elevator, how do they fucking make that look like it is on the outside? Because you don't see like the changes going up into infinity, right? You know,
yeah.
Or maybe they do. Maybe they have some kind of force perspective like tower that just kind of disappears into a vanishing point. I don't know. That'd be pretty fucking cool either way.
Mm-hmm.
Jay says, "Asimov was my favorite author as a child, but Aaron, you give him too much credit. Arthur C. Clarke was the one who said any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, and he's also the one who suggested putting communication satellites in geosynchronous orbit."
Damn.
You're right. I think what I did is I did quite a bit of research into Clarke when I did that 2001 podcast we did last month, and I feel like I just kind of like blended the details with the Asimov details that I did from my pre-scouting foundation, and it just made a mess. Just made a composite nerdy ass golden age sci-fi author in my head. So I appreciate the correction. I'll try to get it straight going forward. J Cube says, if they keep going at the pace they are and filling in the story for time periods in the book, that the book completely skips, it would seem that they may be able to get 3 or 4 seasons just from book one. If, I mean,
that's
they
scary.
Could, they could take each of those mini books and probably blow it into a decent sized season of television. But what's the bad side of that, Jim?
What do they get? There are a lot of books. There are a lot of books. Yeah. I don't think they can do if they do like 3 or 4 seasons with the first book, they're going to have to zip through the others. And I can't imagine that they're any less dense than the first one.
Unless they're planning on just doing the main 3 books and just bringing in like little just vignettes from
maybe
the prequels, yeah, and the sequels to kind of like fill in things like this Demerzel stuff.
That could be so interesting.
I think the pace is going to, like, once they establish stuff, that the pace will kick up and we'll see how that goes. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, like I said, I've seen shows where the pacing is glacial and it's amazing and it's thrilling and it's cool. And I've seen it where like it just damn near kills the narrative pace. So we'll have to see. Mm-hmm. I must say I'm aware of the mystery box of the time vault in the show, but hopefully it'll take us to the same rough place in the books, just in a different way. I think that's all going to collapse in the next episode into the same thing, essentially. And I think the show looks as good as any sci-fi movie that's been released. The acting's been really good for the most part. Just have to keep reminding myself to be open to the drastic changes they have made and will sure continue to make to customize the storyline changes for the series. That's the key. Like, it's a different medium. And what works in books sometimes doesn't work on the screen. So
yeah,
smart adapters know that. And we'll see. We'll see how Goyer does. Final email from Josh H. I can't help but wonder if there's any intentional parallels between the Empire's giant mural, not to mention the opening credits, and the Tibetan Buddhist's sand mandalas. Tibetan monks will create elaborate designs with intricate geometric figures made only of brightly colored sand. There's no bonding agent or anything. The sand is just meticulously laid out grain by grain on a flat surface. Once completed, the design is ritualistically destroyed. The sand is collected and released in a river to rejoin nature. Going to speculate what the significance of the show would be, but the visual similarities make me think something's there. Any thoughts? I mean, I first became aware there's a practice, I think, in season 2 or 3 of House of Cards, where they had some monks at the White House making one of these things and then when the foyers.
Mm-hmm.
And it is striking. They almost use the exact same tools. They load up the sands in this like little funnel thing, and they have these little sticks to vibrate it. They lay it out, like you said, grain. And it seems very similar to what the Kleons are doing on the walls as well. The only difference being these murals, I think, are supposed to stand the test of time. It's very unusual to have an emperor obliterate one.
But they do require maintenance. So there's, you know, some element of that.
Right.
Yeah. The thing that really struck me, and we didn't talk about it in the main podcast, I forgot to, but the mural that Brother Dusk had just painted before, I guess 19 years before, right? But like just last episode for us, is one of destruction. He painted the devastation of the space or the sky bridge.
Star bridge.
Thank you. He painted that, right? And then he goes in and he paints his other mural for the Brother Dawn, that is one of creation. And I we needed more reinforcement of that metaphor, but yeah, there's definitely like a feeling of guilt that he's got as he's painting this, right? Like he didn't do enough during his life to warrant a life, or to warrant the respect that he gets as a Kleon, maybe.
Yeah. And something I learned in like doing the research on the religions of the Game of Thrones is that like, you really get an immersive world when you don't like just like, hey, these guys are Catholics, but you take it like they're Catholics with a little bit of like Odinism and a little bit of like aspect worship from Zoroastrianism. And now you get something, because otherwise it's like, oh, yeah, you get like, oh, these are just medieval Catholics or these are space Catholics or whatever. Whereas if you blend it a little bit, then it feels like something. That's why I think they do so great on The Expanse with the Belter culture.
Yeah.
It's like Belter culture, like what is the dominant culture? Like there's a little bit you can hear, but there's a little bit you can see in the art and in the clothes. Like it's just very much a pastiche of, you know, a lot of the third world countries of 21st century, what if they went and just resettled in the asteroid belt and just blended and mixed and blended and mixed for 300 years? That's where you get like these really cool cultures. So it's not just literally a Tibetan monks mandala, but it's like that. But, you know, like the hieroglyphics of the kings of Egypt to give you like a real kind of, oh, yeah, this feels like a unique kind of culture that's still believable. I think they're doing a really good job because, like, again, I cannot say enough. All this world building is not in the books. None of this Klingon cloning stuff is in the books at all. And it makes it the protagonist and antagonist so much richer for it. So,
and they're doing stuff doing even job. With the visuals to reinforce that, right? Like, I think of, you know, how much societies, when they're confronted with new ideas, morph and change, right? To adopt those new ideas into the old. Like, you look at Catholicism nowadays, it's nothing like it was 2,000 years ago, right? And they reflect that in the mural itself moving and changing over time. It's not something that's completely static. So they've got that imagery with the grains of sand and the stardust and the universal nature of everything embedded into the look of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. It's like they call it concept syncretism when you blend one religion to another to kind of like envelop or mesh it. Like, you know, Christmas as the Roman holiday of Saturnalia, and it's also the Germanic holiday of solstice, and it's all fused into this new thing when the Romans got new religion. It's all blended together. So it's like I said, all this stuff is you don't need it in the show, but it certainly adds a lot of richness and texture, and makes like I think that also helps the suspension of the disbelief, because like, maybe you balk at psychohistory or something, but if the world just feels very real and lived in, then you kind of like give it extra credit, you know, where some worlds feel a lot more fragile, where it's like, geez, you just tug a little bit of a thread and the whole fucking thing's going to collapse like a space elevator. That's it. If you would like to send us some more of your thoughts on Foundation, do so at foundation@baldmove.com. We'll, of course, be back next week with another in-depth look into episode 4. I'm really looking forward to see how Time has developed as a character, because I know it's intimidating for a lot of people, but I think it's the most exciting thing about the hugeness of the story they can tell. So can't wait to see what everybody thinks about it next week. We'll see you here at the same time. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.